words speaking thee, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have special guests with us today, although you're all special. We have with us the Milwaukee High School of the Arts. Would those students please stand?
Big group.
Ooh, wow. That's a good size group.
It is.
It's supposed to be 50, but I'm not going to do a body count. May be seated. The high school students are part of a program run by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It's called Court with Class, and it has won several national awards. Under that program, students from around the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they've gotten copies of the briefs about the case you're about to hear, and they may have done some extra assignments about that case. And then the students will meet with a justice of this court at noon, be joined at that time with students who have been here this morning. So we welcome you under that program. The discussion after the case will be about the procedures of the court, not the substance or substantive matters raised by these cases. And we have an additional group of guests today, Cub Scout Group number 428 from Madison. Would they please stand? We want to welcome you all. You may be seated. Have any information about this case? You do? Okay, fine. If somebody doesn't have information about the case and wants this information, raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary of the case. Okay, we have a few people out here. Okay. So a few more back there. Thank you. Now this Cub Scout group, according to my notes, is Dan Hildebrand's troop. Are you a member of the group or a leader? Well, tell us what your affiliation is. Tell us what your affiliation is.
I'm the father of one of the
Scouts. Good. Okay. Because otherwise I was going to ask you where your uniform was. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with the groups after this argument. Seated to my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I will call our second case for today, 04AP1930-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John F. Scanlon. Representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Robert G. Crone. Attorney Crone.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Crone. I'm retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. And many, many years ago, I was a Cub Scout, too. I'm here Because the director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation has approved an appeal in a multi-count complaint involving Mr. Scanlon, the respondent, one of the counts was dismissed. 17 of the counts were proven, and we are, that is, OLR, has been authorized to appeal 3 of the counts that had been dismissed. The 3 counts involve essentially legal questions and conclusions of law based upon agreed or stipulated facts, and I believe this Court has the authority to undertake a de novo review, and the clearly erroneous standard does not apply. We're also appealing the recommended sanction of 180 days as in our view, to be inappropriate given the substantive violations. Concerning the substantive counts, count 2 of the complaint dealing the so-called McQueen matter deals with a limited question as to an administrative suspension of a law license for nonpayment of dues. The question is whether a failure to inform the court, the client, and the DA in that case of the suspension represents a violation of 22.26(1). The issue is, does it apply? Does that statute apply to administrative sanctions? The referee, without much discussion, and we think an error, indicated or concluded that that statute does not apply to administrative sanctions. There are really 3 cases that we've been able to find, which were reviewed by this court and approved by this court, involving referees' determinations that the statute, the Supreme Court rule in question, did apply to administrative sanctions. So those cases are cited in our brief. Chapter 22.
Mr. Crown, if I could, 22.26 sub 1A says that an attorney whose license is suspended or revoked shall do all of the following: notify by certified mail all clients being represented in pending matters. And when I read that section, and we're dealing here with nonpayment of dues, and I think all the circuit judges and municipal judges that once a year get a list of who hasn't paid their dues and who is temporarily suspended. Is it the OLR's position that every client of every one of those attorneys must receive a letter upon receipt of that suspension in every instance? Is that OLR's position?
OLR's position is that 2226 does apply, and there's no distinction in the substantive language of the rule itself as between administrative or misconduct types of suspensions. And yes, it is the position that that rule applies to administrative suspensions.
Because it seems to me that that's not what the practice is. I think many attorneys, upon getting notified that their license has been temporarily suspended for nonpayment, they pay their dues as quickly as they can and take care of it. And I guess I have a concern that are we putting too high a bar there to say that in every situation now when that letter comes out notifying of the administrative suspensions, we're telling every attorney now get out your letters, write every single client you have, and make sure you notify them that you're suspended. I mean, that just doesn't seem to be the practice.
I don't know. I can't address what lawyers do on that subject. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to look at that rule and to analyze that rule in the context of this case where there was a client involving who was had to make a court appearance in a pending matter, and the lawyer, Mr. Scanlon, was suspended for administrative reasons, didn't advise the court, didn't advise the client, and this rule doesn't
just for how long? I mean, Justice Butler presents a very practical thing. I forgot to pay the dues. I paid the dues and I put on a 37-cent stamp instead of a 39-cent stamp. And it didn't get there on time. And now I'm suspended and, you know, can't I spend a day immediately forwarding the check to the bar and being put back into good standing and not be subject to discipline for practicing law without a license for a day? I mean, as a practical matter.
Well, you have to be practical in analyzing the rule and applying it here.
How long did he practice law without having paid his bar dues?
Here, On October 31, 2002, his license was suspended for failure to pay dues and assessments, and he was not to be reinstated until November 20th of 2002. The court appearance in question was on November 18, 2002, close to 3 weeks after the suspension and a couple of days before he would have been reinstated had he paid those dues.
When did he pay the dues?
Pardon me?
When did he pay the dues?
After that fact, he,
I'm not sure the
exact date, but
okay,
let's see.
So there were 3 weeks, roughly.
Approximately.
All right.
Right.
And if you look at the language of that rule,
and if you look at the definition of misconduct under 20:8.4, there's no real distinction between misconduct based upon substantive violations of Supreme Court rules or misconduct based upon violations of statutes, Supreme Court orders, or otherwise.
I guess my question, once again trying to look at the pragmatic, it's one thing to say that, okay, you've got a pending proceeding. You cannot represent in that pending proceeding because you're suspended, so therefore you should send a letter to your client so your letter can get another attorney or decide how the client wants to proceed.
Right.
But the rule doesn't seem to distinguish it that finely. It doesn't say you send a letter when you have a pending proceeding. It says you send a letter to every client. And that's what troubles me. I'm not sure how OLR enforces the rule. But if you read the rule literally, if you get that notice of suspension, you better get a 1,000 or 100 or however many clients you have, you better get a letter out. Otherwise, you're technically in violation of the rule.
If you read the rule literally, that could be the result, and one would hope that it's not going to be enforced in such a way as to make it ridiculous. Here, there was a pending legal proceeding. There was a 3-week window. There was no notification to the client. In a pending case, the client goes to court, no lawyer, no knowledge by the court. And if you look at sub 2 of that same rule, well, the other portions of that rule talk about suspended attorneys not being able to practice. That particular rule doesn't limit itself to attorneys not just out of the practice or suspended because of misconduct. So the rule, if logically applied, it has to be somewhat interpreted in an integrated fashion. It would seem to me that the rules should apply across the board when you look at the definitions. Now, respondent, I think, draws somewhat of an artificial distinction by talking about the state bar and the bar to board examiners setting forth their rules and so forth. The fact of the matter is this court has supervisory authority over attorneys across the board and is the ultimate authority in terms of regulation. And why shouldn't a court and client know that in a pending case the lawyer is suspended? What difference should it make if it's for administrative reasons or for misconduct reasons?
Now, under what
the system of justice requires that kind of notice.
Under what authority does a suspension because of state bar, under what authority does the fact that you don't pay bar dues cause a suspension? Who made that rule?
Well, I'm assuming that ultimately this court, I don't know, but I'm assuming that ultimately this court passed on that rule and approved that rule in some fashion. Whether you designed it or not, I don't know. But the enforcement of that rule or other rules is ultimately for this court. And I don't want to be too picky over this case on that subject alone, that one count. There are many, many other serious counts, and I'm here primarily because of the dismissal of two other counts in this case, counts 18 and 19. Which involved the violations of 20:8.4c, the dishonesty case, or dishonesty rule. And in this instance, in these two counts, in this case, what's important here is that the facts were admitted and the conclusions of violation of this particular standard must necessarily follow, and that's why we're here. We're not talking about disputed facts or clearly erroneous findings. We're talking about admitted facts. And the court or the referee simply said there's no substantive violation because there was evidence that Mr. Scanlon may have been depressed at some time or was a sloppy bookkeeper. Count 18 involved a conversion of $3,000 of a client, Harbor Village Resorts money. This was admitted. In fact, in Mr. Scanlon's post-hearing brief, by a counsel here, he indicated that the violation and the taking of this money represented a conversion and represented a violation of this particular dishonesty rule. And the referee made that finding, but basically excused the conduct based upon personal circumstances of Mr. Scanlon. Likewise, there was a finding by the referee that Mr. Scanlon received $1,000 for Harbor Village and put it in his business account. He didn't find other facts that were uncontested, that being that the account when it was deposited was already overdrawn, and those funds went to pay the overdraft penalties. The referee didn't find other facts that were admitted, that the very next day Mr. Scanlon made a payment to Harbor, which did not include the $1,000 that he had collected the day before. So when one looks at this violation, 20:8.4, it seems to be interpreted in a rather unique fashion by this referee. The rule talks about engaging in conduct involving dishonesty. The referee seems to have excused his conduct and reads into the rule the element of intent. Now, I'm aware that this court has, perhaps under advisement, whether this rule should be based upon intentional wrongdoing. Right now, as I understand, the Nickmeyer case, the Marks case, and the Van Grohl case, that kind of finding is not necessary. And in Van Grohl, we had a situation where client funds weren't returned. There was a finding that the attorney didn't act purposefully, yet this court approved a determination that there was conversion and a violation of 28.4. So here we have a conversion, uncontroverted facts, an admission within the post-hearing brief of respondent's attorney that it's a conversion and it's a violation of the rule, but the referee, for some mysterious reason, simply said, well, he's a sloppy bookkeeper. I think that that determination or that analysis, if applicable at all, should have been in the context of consideration of sanction and not as an absolute defense to the charge. Likewise, count 19. With the same client. There's $48,000 of telephone transfers from a trust account. The referee made critical findings of certain phone transfers from trust accounts that were unaccounted for. He omitted other findings as to 33 phone transfers from a trust account and a business account that were admitted in the answer of respondent to the complaint. $48,000 goes from a trust account for clients unknown into a business account. The referee has those facts before him, makes partial findings, all of the facts are admitted, but again says this is a product of the respondent's poor bookkeeping practices or sloppy bookkeeping practices. Now, this takes us to the question of sanction. I think that, quite honestly, this court has the authority to complete what the referee started here and acknowledge the findings that he made and rule as a matter of law that counts 18 and 19 were proven. There was a conversion. We're talking about not insignificant amounts of money here, $3,000 to Harbor and a number of unaccounted for telephone transfers from a trust account. Now, we recommended a 2-year suspension in this case, and the referee made his determination of 180-day suspension just under the threshold for reapplication to get a law license back. We point out to this court that there were multiple clients here. I haven't even addressed the findings of the fact that are not subject to appeal and the many other counts here involving many other clients. I will at this time, but we have two cases involving situations where clients were having to chase down Mr. Scanlon to get fees back that were paid for work that wasn't done. One client had to resort to the client security fund and got paid. We have the conversion. We have multiple counts here. We have neglect and failure to cooperate. We have a client who had two judgments taken against him. We had a client in court without an attorney, not notified of a suspension. So if you look at all of these charges, and admittedly, I will be the first to admit that Mr. Scanlon doesn't have a disciplinary history. You're going to hear that he was cooperative, and once charges were filed and the matter was in front of the referee, he was cooperative. But I think this referee, quite honestly, decided this case on kind of the nice guy defense. Mr. Scanlon presented well. He is a nice gentleman, seemed to be somewhat remorseful. But as this court recently stated, and I understand this case was handed out today in the Converse case, the nice guy defense only goes so far. You have violations. You have trust account violations. You have conversion and a violation of the dishonesty standard. And nice guy or not, those violations are there, and they're serious. And the cases that we cited in our brief do talk about a longer-term suspension that at least requires reinstatement application. One is the Edgar case, which was a 2-year suspension for conversion. The Ciccone case involved a 1-year suspension. There was no misappropriation there, and the money was refunded. The Archie case was a 1-year suspension. There was $3,000 of funds unaccounted for. And I would be the first to admit that cases go in all directions on this. But I think when you're talking about dishonesty and conversion, you're talking about a serious level of misconduct that ratchets things up a bit into a more significant suspension, notwithstanding a clean disciplinary history and notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Scanlon presented in a positive, nice fashion.
Well, is this a medical problem? Is this a medical case?
Yes. The medical problems in the case consisted of a psychiatrist, mental health provider, who did testify. This was not the mental health provider that was providing services at the time of the misconduct. It was a mental health provider that inherited the case after Mr. Scanlon had moved to Illinois and testified that he did have...
Let me ask, just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the mental health problems were occurring. This isn't after. They were occurring during these difficulties, during his problems?
Well, the mental health provider who testified that he would have thought that these problems could well have interfered with Mr. Scanlon's ability to practice, even though he wasn't treating him at that time, taking somewhat of a retrospective review of it, and did find that those problems most likely were long-lasting and were interfering at some level with his practice.
I guess, so there was no treatment for any problems while this conduct took place?
No, there was treatment, but the treaters did not testify. The person who testified was a mental health provider who came on board after the misconduct, after he had relocated elsewhere.
But this is not a medical incapacity case.
It is not.
And so this is a mitigation of discipline.
Correct.
Use. So tell me what the rule is in the cases about medical issues that do not rise to or are not claimed as a medical incapacity case.
I understand the cases from this court, and I've had some experience with several of them, require some type of clear nexus between the mental health condition and the misconduct, and that assuming that is in place, such evidence can serve as a consideration as it relates to sanction. I do not believe, as this referee determined, that the mental health issues serve as a defense on the merits to the misconduct charge. Now, that's my understanding of what this court has done. And
now, did he use it for merits, or did he use it for mitigation of discipline?
Well, I think he used it for both. When I talked earlier about the dishonesty counts 18 and 19 of the complaint that were dismissed, the referee said, this isn't dishonesty, this is sloppy bookkeeping, he's been depressed, so forth and so on. So I believe he used that defense on the merits and shouldn't have. And I also think he gave Mr. Scanlon the benefit of considerable doubt on the sanction using the same mental health questions.
So was there proof of a clear nexus between mental health and conduct, in your opinion?
Well, I think there was proof that the health care provider did testify that he would have believed that the mental health conditions that existed at the time may have interfered with his practice, okay? So is that a clear nexus? The only point I would like to make is we have to look at the nature of the violations. As I understand mental health defenses, when a person is depressed, this court has looked at situations where they don't cooperate with their attorney, they can't be found, there's failure to communicate. This case involved bookkeeping. This case involved telephone transfers. This case involved accounting done by Mr. Scanlon that on very many occasions was done correctly. And it's more of a purposeful type of conduct that doesn't seem to me the dishonesty The dishonesty count, in my view, there's no defense to that based upon mental health issues. After all, he's receiving money on one day that belongs to a client. He puts it in the wrong account. The next day he makes a distribution to the client, does not include the money he received. The $3,000 was by his own admission converted. And I just don't see logically, notwithstanding the fact that the mental health provider did say that these conditions could create difficulties in a private practice, I just don't see that where you have somebody making these kind of purposeful bookkeeping entries and distributions from time to time, that one could, that it logically follows that depression would somehow or another be an influence there. And I think the referee gave it way too much weight.
I was looking at the, while you were listening to you and looking in the blue brief here, as far as what the diagnosis of the psychiatrist, the mental health provider, was. He's been diagnosed with bipolar, manic. So it's not, you said depression, but there's
well, there's different levels of depression, the words bipolar may well have been used, but if you look at the nature of the conduct and what the charges are, I just don't see that.
I was just finding out from my own, and just looking at the report itself, as far as what the there's no exaggeration of what the diagnosis.
I will let counsel address that specific diagnosis. It really wasn't challenged. The question is really, he was not hospitalized. He was not showing up for work. He was not doing the kinds of things that people under bipolar types of behavior usually do. No hospitalization.
I read in the facts that he would stay in bed rather than going to work. That's what, at least.
There was some of that occasionally, but that wasn't really well defined, I don't think, in this record.
Mr. Cohen, can I ask you about the argument centering on sanctions? I thought it was very interesting that the referee seemed to be basing a good part of his recommendation on sanctions, comparing a recommendation that OLR had made in another case with the recommendation made by OLR in this case. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to that. Is that an appropriate consideration, or do you think the referee should be looking only at the compendium in making a recommendation?
The referee, who also happened to be the referee in this other case, and that's the Eisenberg case, made a huge point of that. Quite honestly, I didn't think the Eisenberg case was on all fours or was a very good precedent to even consider in the context of the kind of facts we had here. And we addressed that with the referee, he just wanted to hear more about a comparison to this Eisenberg case. And we pointed out in the brief we didn't think they were similar. This case rises or falls on its own merits, and the violations were different and the circumstances were different.
Speaking of precedent, the number 180 days appears to me to be unusual. Apparently done in an effort to be just short of the 6 months. When we do 4-month or 5-month revocation, how do you deal with 180 days, and do you have any comments regarding that?
And that was one of my problems, too. Usually, as I remember these orders, although I could be wrong, generally say something like 30 days. Well, we don't do 30 days. We do 60 days. Sometimes we do 90 days. But then we do 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 9 months, mm-hmm. 1 year. We don't count up the number of days. And shouldn't we be consistent on that?
That's what I was trying to ask.
You did a very good job.
Apparently not.
I can answer both of your questions.
With one answer, by the way.
One answer to both questions. I think it would be nice if this court was consistent on that subject. I have no explanation as to where this referee came up with 180 days. It's a sanction, a type of sanction I hadn't seen before. But it seems to have been for the purpose of just getting under the 6-month reapplication requirement.
Did he put any conditions on getting back in, like a psychiatric evaluations? I mean, if you've got somebody who has a chronic disease.
No, he did create conditions of restitution, which is also a little bit unusual because, on the one hand, he's saying that the poor business practices led to the misconduct and the dishonesty. On the other hand, he's ordering restitution. And he did order restitution to the one client who lost money to the client security fund and did order restitution of $3,086.67 to Harbor, which was the foundation for the dishonesty count. Nothing was ordered concerning counseling. Nothing was asked for on that subject.
Is there any precedent for ordering restitution for a count that was found to be not violated?
I don't know of any precedent for that. He ordered restitution. Well, the client didn't get the money. He acknowledged that he kept the money, and the money was to go to the client, but the referee determined it did not represent dishonesty. The fact is, the client was out the money, so I don't think that would be inappropriate to order restitution as was done. I think he violated the rule as well. But is there any precedent for that? I don't know of any, but I don't think it's inappropriate.
Mr. Crowe, could you make the argument once more a little bit clearer to me of why this court can find different facts than the referee did?
I'm not asking. I see my red light is on, but I assume I can. We're not asking this court to interpret facts or make new findings of facts. There's a listing of facts here that this referee admitted or found, and other facts that were admitted, and the referee simply didn't complete his findings. And we're asking the court, in the interest of justice, to make a full review of this and to complete the findings. What he did find is enough to make a finding of a rule violation. But in addition, there are a couple things he didn't find that are in the record and that were admitted in the answer and simply weren't commented upon. I don't think it's inappropriate for this court, under those circumstances, to make those findings. It's not contested facts where you're trying to sort out who said what or it's not a clearly erroneous standard test.
Is it your argument that these are questions of law as presented at this point?
At this point, they're questions of law, that whether these admitted facts represent violations. He said that the bookkeeping practices and depression served as a defense, and that's what caused the misconduct and dishonesty. We think not. We think this is a question of law that was proven. The underlying facts leading to that question are in the record and were proven and found by the referee and or admitted by the respondent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crowe. Mr. Hildebrand, representing Mr. Scanlon.
Thank you, Your Honors. may it please the Court. The argument regarding the applicability of 22.26 to administrative suspensions is simply based on the text of the statute itself or the rules. Chapter 21 of the SCRs is called Lawyer Regulation System. It defines what's in the system. Chapter 22 is Procedures for the Lawyer Regulation System. Outside of the lawyer regulation system is the State Bar and the CLE, the Board of Bar Examiners. And I would respectfully point out that in each of those rules, and we cited them in our brief, it says that a lawyer shall not practice law if he or she is under one of these administrative suspensions. That's also in 22.26. Now, the remedy for practicing law under an administrative suspension is a violation of 8.4F, violating a Supreme Court rule or order, or 5.5, practicing law without a license. There is no basis the way these rules should be construed to have 22.26 come in, and there's a good reason for that. As Justice Butler pointed out, people would be in violation of this, of the, this whole scheme of things if they were a couple of days late. Here,
suppose they're 2 years late.
Now, then if they're 2 years late, they should be prosecuted under 8.4F, violating the Supreme Court rule, or 5.5, practicing law without a license.
And they appear in court?
Yes, and that's actually what happened in some cases.
Here's what 10011 says. Membership, and this is a Supreme Court rule, membership in the association, which is the state bar, shall be a condition precedent to the practice of law. How can, then you're telling me, not a member under Chapter 10, but you can go to court?
No, I'm not saying. I'm saying that if you do, you violate 8.4F. And that's what happens when
the court... What authority does the trial court say to you, you can't practice here?
Pardon me?
Under what authority does the trial court say, you can't practice here, you haven't paid your bar dues?
Well, the trial court, according to the rules, is supposed to be notified by the state bar or the...
Okay, so they're notified.
Yes, they are notified.
And so, but can the trial court say, don't practice here?
Well, I think a trial court could raise that issue with a lawyer who's under suspension, yes.
Could. I'm not asking raise. I'm saying, can you say you are barred from this courtroom because you have not fulfilled the condition precedent, you have no right to practice law in Wisconsin?
If the court has a notice from the state bar or the board of bar examiners, yes.
Okay. So can get rid of the lawyer.
Well,
so you've got someone who's practicing law without a license.
What happened here is that he appeared in court, and I believe it's count 7 or 8, before he got the actual notice of suspension. The referee found in Scanlon's favor on that. The OLR did not appeal that. Okay? But then they did say that when he did get notice, he should have notified everybody, including this one client. And the fact of the matter is, I think that was on the 18th of November, and he was reinstated before the end of the month. That's what we're talking about here. And, of course, I certainly don't intend, nor does my client intend, any disrespect for this court by saying that this court regulates the legal profession. But I think that this court has drafted rules and provided remedies, and all I'm asking is for the Office of Lawyer Regulation to follow the rules when they make charges. And that wasn't done here. 22.26 does not apply to this situation. And as I said, our argument is simply based on the text of the rules that have been published. Now, I'd like to talk about the trust account situation. First of all, all this discussion.
Let's look at the rules once again. 1003 subsection 6 says the penalty for non-payment of dues after 120 days is the membership of the member may be suspended. No person whose membership is suspended may practice law. 2226 says license suspended. An attorney whose license is suspended. Is this lawyer's license suspended?
Yes, it is.
They don't pay dues. Okay.
But you see, that statute, 22.26, applies to the lawyer regulation system. SCR 10.036 says no person whose membership is so suspended for nonpayment of dues or assessment may practice law. That's the rule.
Why can't we say that 2201 has to be read with 1003? Because you're just cutting for no reason, treating SCR 10 differently from SCR 22.
The reason is because this court defined the components of the lawyer regulation system in SCR 21.01 very clearly, and it does not include the state bar or the board of bar examiners. It's right here in the rule.
Which rule?
21.01.
Lawyer regulation 22.0019 that defines misconduct.
Well, it is misconduct to violate a Supreme Court rule, but he wasn't charged with that. He wasn't charged with 8.4F.
But the point I'm trying to make is 2226 talks about a license being suspended. Now, the license could be suspended under Chapter 22 or could be suspended under Chapter 10. There's nothing in Chapter 22 that says that suspension of license is different under 10, Chapter 10.
Well, that's true, but Chapter 22 applies only to the lawyer regulation system. And I think there's reason for that because of the practicalities that Justice Butler referred to when he was questioning my opponent.
Well, if a rule is followed, I think I won't pay dues except for every other year. I don't want to get into the three-year problem because then there's special rules for reinstating me. But I can keep my $500, earn no interest on it, and then pay the bar.
Well, let me say this. A year or so ago, I argued the Polich case, and he didn't pay his dues, and he was suspended. And as I recall that case, he was charged and admitted violating practicing law without a license. He didn't. The 22.26 didn't come up, as I recall.
So the case doesn't help you or hinder you.
All I'm saying is that we have rules here, and my point is that OLR, when they charge a person, ought to charge them with violating the right rule. And 22.26, I think by its terms and by the definitions, doesn't apply.
Mr. Hildebrand, do you have 22.26 in front of you?
Yes.
Would you comment on subsection 3?
Well, when a lawyer gets suspended and seeks reinstatement, then he or she has to show that he did not or she did not practice law during the term of suspension. And that's part of the standard order that this court issues when it suspends lawyers in disciplinary cases. And that goes to the point that I think I'm trying to make here is that this rule is designed to address lawyers who are suspended for disciplinary reasons, not administrative reasons.
The point I was trying to make, I think the charge, the count is that notice was not given to clients, wasn't it?
That's right.
All right. But he was reinstated.
Yes, several days later.
Okay. How could he have been reinstated if he didn't show that he had informed the clients?
That's the point. In the footnote in my brief, I think there were hundreds of lawyers who were reinstated either by the State Bar or the Board of Bar Examiners when they paid their dues or sent in their CLE forms, and they certainly didn't go through this process. They didn't. They just sent in their check or their CLE form. Again, that shows that this rule doesn't apply. Now, I would like to talk about this trust account issue. First of all, Mr. Cohn was arguing that somehow the referee's order of restitution was inconsistent with his finding that there was no violation of 8.4C, the dishonesty rule. My point is that these violations that were admitted and were found were all violations of the trust account rules. So the question is, I think here, is a violation of the trust account rule, whether you call it commingling or paying yourself money out of the trust when you shouldn't, is that automatically a violation of 8.4C? That's what OLR seems to be suggesting, and I contend that it is not an automatic violation because dishonesty has to involve some intent. And the referee didn't make those kinds of findings. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have to pay the money back. He violated the trust account rules, and that was admitted. What it does mean is that OLR is just piling up on the charges with absolutely no reason or no consequence. That's what happened in this one count. Now, the next trust account violation is that he, and I'll read from the complaint, paragraph 129, by transferring over $48,000 in funds from his client trust account to his personal account without identifying and knowing the purpose of this withdrawal and to whom the funds belong, Scanlon violated 8.4C. What he did admit to was commingling. What he did admit to was not having proper records. What he does not admit to is taking, except for that $3,000, which was admitted from Harbor, what he does not admit to is taking $48,000 of other people's money and putting it in his pocket. They did not prove that he took any money other than this $3,000 that didn't belong to him. And obviously the referee was compelled to dismiss this count because there was no proof of fraud. Who was defrauded? Who was cheated? Nobody. He commingled. And he didn't keep proper records, but he didn't cheat someone out of $48,000. And that is one of the things that I think is most unfortunate about this appeal. We have $3,000. We don't have $48,000. And finally, I'd like to...
So what's the penalty for taking $3,000?
Well, as my distinguished opponent says, the penalties are all over the map. It's very interesting. They come in here and they look for a two-year suspension. They have only one case that they cite, which really isn't applicable. The other cases they cite are 1 year or less. The cases I cite, and I think the case that's really closest on par here is the Jacobson case, where a lawyer who engaged in similar conduct, including trust account violations, got a 5-month suspension. And like my client, he had these medical problems. The referee made findings about these medical problems, or at least he paraphrased the testimony, and they were very serious. Bipolar and depression, which this treating person emphasized, were causal to the misconduct. The OLR takes no account of this. And it is true. Having
is it causal for the theft, or is it causal for bad record keeping?
It's causal for the whole thing. People who are afflicted with severe depression and this kind of thing can't function. Everybody that's in the field would test it. But I will also say this: to top it off, during the time this happened, my client was undergoing a divorce and going through a custody battle for his 4 kids. We came in and tried this case, and he didn't present a nice guy defense like my opponent says. That's totally false. He admitted his wrongdoing and submitted himself and expressed remorse and did what he could. He didn't really fight all these charges, but what he is fighting is the piling on and the excessive recommendations for discipline that the referee found were excessive.
Should there be conditions on his reinstatement relating to his mental health?
We suggested that in his brief. If he is to practice law in Wisconsin again, we suggested some kind of trust account monitoring and the like. The referee
didn't suggest. What about mental health?
Pardon me?
What about requiring treatments?
Well, he's undergoing treatments now. I don't think that would be a problem.
At least where we would get some type of response, this court would, or OLR, someone would be able to monitor whether or not he would be capable of going back in practice of law.
It's been done in other cases, yes.
Is there any drug abuse here?
Pardon me?
Substance abuse or drug abuse?
I'm not aware of any. I mean, alcohol or drugs, I'm not aware of any, no. We have a lawyer here.
What about the propriety of the referee in this case comparing recommendations by OLR in a totally different case rather than comparing sanctions that were imposed in similar cases based on the compendium? Do you see any problem with that?
Well, I think the referee singled out one case. The problem with the referee in singling out that case is that he did it. But he had the same cases before him that we've cited in our brief. He had Mr. Crone's cases, and I would just really urge this court to look at the Jacobson case, which is a 5-month suspension. And I think what happened in that case, and based on this record, it totally belies, I think, the somewhat disrespectful arguments made concerning the referee giving him a pass or adopting a nice guy defense. That didn't occur here. And I can stand up with a straight face to this court and write a brief that says maybe 180 days is too much. Maybe it ought to be 2 or 3 months based on these cases, and particularly the Jacobson case, which I think is the closest case we have here. That was a 5-month suspension.
Did the Jacobson case involve the number of counts or anything close to the number of counts at issue here?
It was a pretty serious case. I think all these cases are different. But I would respectfully urge the court to look at that case very carefully. And then as far as the other counts are concerned, there was a succession of cases, including the Kasperitz case, where there was a whole laundry list of counts, and the lawyer got a public reprimand on a first offense basis. If you put Jacobson and Kasperitz together, and then the Springfield Woodward case, which was a 2-month suspension for a lot of trust account violations, it's hard for me to understand why the OLR is asking this court for a 2-year suspension.
If I recall correctly, the Kasperis case, the OLR recommended more than we ultimately imposed.
True.
And in the Jacobson case, the OLR recommended less, and we added a couple of months on to it.
I think that the OLR should make recommendations based upon what this court has ordered in similar cases. And it is true, and I think everybody in the courtroom knows this, that there's no two cases alike. But seriously, this case was not defended, and my client did not defend himself on the basis that he didn't do anything wrong. It was a very unfortunate, difficult period in his life. He violated the rules, and he owned up to it. But we're here because of excessive requests for discipline and the piling on of charges which are duplicative of other charges, and the allegation that by simply taking your own money out of a trust account, somehow that's fraud, which it isn't. It's commingling, and he admitted that. So I hope this court does not go away from this argument thinking that I'm representing someone here who isn't willing to own up to his responsibility. The restitution was agreed to, was not contested. And the restitution is properly there because my client violated the trust account rules.
Mr. Hildebrand, discipline is not a criminal proceeding. But I think back to criminal cases. The prosecution can, in a criminal case, charge as many crimes for the same conduct as the statutes permit. And the statutes, to do that, can have slightly different elements, slightly different methods of proof, etc. And so for one act, one conduct, you can be liable for 3 or 4 state statutes. And you can punish for each of them, and they can be consecutive.
That's all of which is true.
All of which is true. So why in discipline can't OLR charge the violation of 4, 5, 6 rules, and the conduct violates all of them, and you're disciplined really for violating 5 rules?
Well, but I don't think that's the way this court really applies the rules of discipline. I mean, if someone takes $3,000 out of his trust account, whether or not OLR chooses to charge him with 5 different rules or 4 or 3 or 2 or 1, I think this court endeavors to look, this fella did this, and this is what he deserves. So, yes, the OLR can make these charges, but I think in practice this court will look.
So it's not overpiling if you ask for 4 different offenses.
No, but what
because
is?
Because you don't know what the ultimate proof is going to be.
Right.
Okay.
But it is overpiling here on this appeal in this respect because the referee held that OLR didn't prove the conversion and the fraud. That what they proved was trust account violations and.
It's not overpiling. That's not overpiling. They were unable to prove, if you're right, 1 offense or 2 offenses, whatever it is. So that's just part of prosecution. That happens, right? It's
right.
Like a plaintiff in a case doesn't prove the cause of action. You're arguing that the problem here is just the discipline.
Well, that's part of the problem. I don't think, put it this way, I don't think that, I think that if you want to talk about the law of conversion, of course, is very broad. It can be unintentional. I think conversion, in that sense, will support a violation of the trust account rules, but not 8.4C, which is fraud, deceit, misrepresentation.
May or may not.
No. The point is that, okay, he converted $3,000 of Harbor, and it's a violation of the trust account rules, and he has to pay it back. Why is the OLR here saying, oh, the referee should have found that he was dishonest and given him a greater penalty? I don't know. I don't think the court functions that way in these kinds of
cases. Well, it does if there's proof of dishonesty. Now, you may not think it's dishonest, but another person might, right?
Well, I do think it was. I do think it was dishonest, but the referee's findings didn't prove that, and if it didn't come up with that, and if this court is going to respect the findings of the referee.
Well, do you agree that on the basis of those findings, we could find as a matter of law it does fulfill a rule violation?
Not on the basis of the findings. You could find it on the basis of admissions that we made, yes.
Maybe not on the basis of these findings, because you don't want to concede anything against your client, but as a principle of law, Mr. Hildebrand.
Right.
You can find, if the referee makes findings A, B, C, or D, this court could say as a matter of law that equals a particular rule violation charge.
That, of course, is true.
And that's the OLR's position. Now, I don't know whether it's acceptable or not, but the position is valid.
What I'm trying to get across to the court is that I have a client here who came in and essentially made all sorts of admissions, and I think that he did that, didn't put all our to its proof. It's a lot of these things, and I think that ought to be considered in his favor. And I also think that the fact that he was suffering from the horrible effects of depression and these other conditions while undergoing through a divorce ought to be taken into account by this court. And I think the referee got this case about right. It's an experienced referee. And just because he talked about the Eisenberg case doesn't defeat the overall justice of what the referee recommended here. And my yellow light is on, and unless there's other questions, I will sit down.
Yes, there is another question.
Okay, Justice.
Mr. Hildebrand, my recollection is that you represented Attorney Marvin Marks.
I sure did.
And undoubtedly read the opinion in that case. And that there was a conclusion by the court that on, is it 8-4C, a mental element isn't required.
Well, I don't think that's quite true. I think what the court said is that there was enough facts there. In other words, he sent a letter saying that he had a lien when he knew he didn't have a lien because his fee agreement said no lien if you only have $1,000 or something. But the court was willing to infer intent from those facts. Now, what the court also said in that opinion was this is not the same as the tort of misrepresentation where you have to prove intent. And that's where Marx left us. I'm not arguing this case on the basis of no intent. I'm really arguing this case, at least on that first count where the OLR claims there was a conversion, on the basis that the referee did not make the proper findings, and that this court, in a number of cases, including the Wood case and others, said that we will not make findings where the referee could have but didn't. And that's all I'm saying. My client did admit taking that money.
Which money is this, 48 or 3?
Pardon me?
Which admission? 3,000, is that it?
3,000, okay. 3,100 or whatever. But we take specific exception to the count 19 where they say because he took money out of his trust account and didn't provide an explanation, he's guilty of fraud. There's no basis for that.
Now, you're involved with revising the ethics rules, are you not?
Yes, sir.
Am I wrong that some of those ethical rules are being revised in light of the Marx case?
Well, I can say that it was a concern of the Ethics 2000 Commission that that there ought to be a stronger intentional element involved in 8.4C. And I know that OLR submitted some comments to the court that you ought to leave 8.4C alone. But I do think there is some difficulty with 8.4C in figuring out what kind of intent, if any, is required, or are lawyers to be guarantors of absolutely everything they say and everything they do. So there are some problems there. There's the Shea case. I think I can't remember the site. I think it's 126 was second, where the court got into intent and said that that even though he took money from the law firm, the board didn't prove an intent to take it. But what they disciplined Shea for was for lying to his law firm. So this whole intent thing is kind of up in the air, as Your Honor indicated, I think, by talking about Marx and the Nick Meyer case and some of these others. Okay, well, thank you very much.
One other.
Okay.
6 months, 180 days. Could you comment on that?
Yes. Frankly, the referee, I think, said 180 days because he didn't think that my client should be put to the burdens of a reinstatement proceeding. He's out of the state. Again, what purpose is there in the discipline? I think on this record, though, that, and particularly when you look at Jacobson, who received 5 months, it would certainly be appropriate for this court to impose something less than 180 days. But reading the mind of the referee, of course, is we have some distinguished former circuit judges on this court. It's sometimes difficult to really understand what was going through the mind of the trier of facts. But I would certainly hope that this court would look at this entire record and do what's fair. And as I say, based on Jacobson, I think 5 months would be more than fair. And it certainly shows, when you look at that case, I think it shows that the referee never brought some supposed nice guy defense. We never made that defense, and the referee didn't buy it either, or didn't even do that. Again, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Mr. Cohn.
Thank you. I don't wish to belabor this administrative suspension issue much longer, but 2101F points out that the Supreme Court is a component of the lawyer regulation system, and 2228, this is a Chapter 22 rule that includes SCR Chapter 10 dues issues and suspensions based upon Chapter 31, the Board of Bar Examiners.
Is that, give me the cite for that again.
2228.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Crone, just on that point, Justice Prosser referred to sub 3 of that rule. And as I understand it, if we interpret the rule as you suggest, then as a condition of reinstatement, every attorney is going to have to submit proof that letters were sent to every client before that attorney can be reinstated. That's how I would read that rule, if your interpretation is correct.
I think the rule applies to administrative suspensions, and if you apply the rule says what it says, and whether it's going to be followed in the sense of forcing people to comport with that particular sub 3 standard or not, if that becomes a practical problem for the courts or OLR, they're going to have to interpret how they're going to deal with that. But I acknowledge that
we need more personnel, won't we?
Pardon me?
Personnel, won't we?
I don't know about that. On the subject of intent, I think this court, contrary to what Mr. Hildebrand said, I think has already carved out the law on intent as it relates to an 8.4C violation, as Justice Prosser had mentioned. The Marks case and others, Van Gruhl and others, have pretty much indicated that as the law exists right now, intent is not a prerequisite for a dishonesty finding. It's misconduct or conduct involving dishonesty. And the intent element, although it may be in the future written into the rule, it's not a part of that rule now. I regret the suggestion that the court might be left with that this is a piling on situation. A mere reading of the complaint would show that there are discrete violations and discrete charges that are not duplicitous. Taking the $3,000 of a client's money that should go to them and that as a part of your collection process and put it in your business account and not paying it over to them, excuse me, in our view, is not piling on. It's dishonesty and a violation of 8.4C. And Mr. Hildebrand, in his brief, so much as admitted. You have an awkward situation here where the referee makes findings A, B, C, D, E. Mr. Hildebrand acknowledges this to the $3,000, the conversion of the violation, but the referee says, well, too bad, sloppy bookkeeping. I think this court, this is a search for the truth. I don't think we exist in a void here, and I think the court has the authority to look at this record and say these facts, these admissions warrant a finding of this violation. Jacobson is not that similar to this case as suggested by Mr. Hildebrand. I happen to be involved in the prosecution of that case. Mr. Jacobson, at or about the very time of some serious trust account violations, had a heart attack, was hospitalized, and had mental health issues that followed that heart attack that were very well documented. Before we get, and I don't want to be accused of being too heavy-handed here, but I'm also concerned that we're getting a little bit warm and fuzzy over this notion of bipolar. That word is out there, and it has some serious implications. But in this record, there is not much evidence at all other than a mental health care provider saying he's now got bipolar. He may have had that before. It could affect law practice. But he's dealing with money, making business, transactional accounts, back and forth, in and out of account. And my view of bipolar conduct, you wouldn't even be at work or you wouldn't be doing anything. But he's handling financial transactions in a way that his client is not getting paid. And he is profiting. As far as the $48,000 of telephone transfers, my only response to that would be it didn't seem critical in our view that we would have to show whose money that was. The fact is that was trust account money. It was transferred from trust account to his own funds without an identification of whose money it was or whether it was, in fact, Mr. Scanlon's money. It was simply transferred out. And without an explanation, it was our belief that that warranted a finding of conduct involving dishonesty. So based upon that record, we feel that the referee in this case, for reasons that are hard to understand, filed an incomplete report in terms of his conclusions that this court, I think, is duty-bound to follow up on to determine violations. And I think the referee simply got off on a tangent of analyzing this case in the context of another matter that he happened to be the referee in that bore no similarity to what we have here. And for those reasons, we've taken this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand, for your argument in this attorney discipline case. Attorney discipline cases are always very difficult for the OLR and for the respondent lawyer and for the court. We are in recess until 1:30. We close the 04AP19:30D. OLR versus Scanlon, and I will be out promptly to talk about this case with the students.